Well, perhaps we should begin. I would like to place this lecture under a motto taken from the novel, Dr. Zhivago. And I think it is a quote that leads to the very center of this novel, and also in many ways to my thinking. And I think it should be pondered, this particular motto, in the context of the evangelization conference going on here at Holden right now. One character in the novel has the following to say about Christianity and the Christian faith. A quote: "I think that if the beast who sleeps in man could be held down by threat, any kind of threat, whether of jail or of retribution after death, then the highest emblem of humanity would be the lion tamer in the circus with his whip, not the prophet who sacrificed himself. But don't you see, this is just the point. What has for centuries raised man above the beast is not the cudgel, but an inward music, the irresistible power of unarmed truth, the powerful attraction of its example. It has always been assumed that the most important things in the Gospels are the ethical maxims and commandments. But for me, the most important thing is that Christ speaks in parables taken from life, that he explains the truth in terms of everyday reality. The idea that underlies this is that communion between mortals is immortal, and that the whole of life is symbolic because it is meaningful." Now, turning to Pasternak, I feel that several misunderstandings have grown up around him. The first misunderstanding was that the novel became a bestseller. And could not be published in the Soviet Union, and so it had the taint of the illegal, of a book, of a kind of Russian political underground, because the novel contains many critical references to Marxism and the conditions in the Soviet Union. But these few quotes were always kind of torn out of context by the journalists, and they didn't see that the criticism which Pasternak leveled against Marxism was very as much leveled against any kind of ideology, any kind of systematic simplification of the complexity of life. And that really the West stood as much accused as did the East. This was the first misunderstanding. And the second misunderstanding, I think, which I hope won't bury the novel, is the movie. The bestseller and the movie. And the movie, too, has tried very hard to capture some of the flavor of the novel, but it has succeeded in presenting only one strand from this very complex novel, namely the love story. Now, the love story is very important in the context of the novel, but it is not merely the romantic love. It is love in a metaphysical sense, and that hardly comes through in the movie. Now, I'd like to glance back a little bit at the history of Russian literature to place the achievement of Pasternak and this novel. As you all know, the first great age of Russian literature is the age that goes from Pushkin, the greatest Russian poet who died in 1837, to the death of Chekhov at the turn of the century. This 19th century was the age of a great novel and a short story. And it is a very close-knit tradition of certain themes which are taken up by most of these Russian novelists. Poetry and the drama was in the 19th century marginal, secondary. And the novel, the Russians Kind of took to and developed with such intensity that today many of us feel that the greatest novels are indeed Russian. When you think of the greatest novels, kind of standards by which to measure other novels, you probably will, using Dostoevsky and Tolstoy as your standard, or as one witty critic once put it, the greatest Russian novelist is Tolstoyevsky. This intensity, this exemplary kind of character of the Russian novel, I think can be explained by the following, namely that it includes both depth and breadth. By depth I mean a concern with metaphysics, with religious problems, with psychological penetration, and the breadth. By breadth, I mean the social conditions, the social manners, the political situation. And it's interesting that this Russian novel, this classical Russian novel of the 19th century, presents us authors who are more than merely writers. They are really spokesmen and the conscience of the whole nation. And many of them paid for this right with their lives, or went into exile, or were persecuted in other ways. But the writers definitely felt that their task was more than merely to write entertaining novels. Their task was really kind of to sum up the experience of the nation and to give voice to the anxieties and the kind of searchings and doubts and the hopes of their people. And therefore, the writer in Russia, from the 19th century onward, has been always very revered and has been feared by the authorities and has been loved by the people. So literature is taken more seriously in Russia, has been taken more seriously in the 19th century, and this is still true today. Now, after this first phase of Russian literature, really the novel could not be surpassed by any other author, and so in the 1890s there came a second great period, and this period is the period of Russian poetry. You could say that poetry struck back with a burst of major poets and movements in the 1890s, and this kind of fruitful fermentation continued until 1930, when the Stalinist kind of terror set in, a regimentation requiring socialist realism and really subduing any kind of creative freedom that the writers had had up to 1930 to a certain degree. The poetry written between 1890 and 1930 is a poetry that speaks of a longing for freedom, that celebrates freedom, which many thought that the revolution of 1970 had finally brought. Now it's interesting to note that the great tradition of Russian literature begins with a poet, with Pushkin. And Pushkin, too, is not merely a writer of collections of poems, but the author of short stories and of a novel which has been very often classified as a fountainhead of Russian literature, and I refer here to the novel in verse, Eugene Onegin. Now, this novel in verse really contains, in a kind of germinal state, the central characters and the main preoccupations of the great Russian novel. But the verse novel, of course, translates very poorly, and so there have been several translations made, and none really has achieved yet a perfect translation that would convey some of this quality. There's a very good translation by Vladimir Nabokov, the author of Lolita, who spent some 15 years, I think, in working out this translation, which is followed by two volumes of commentary. So you can see how significant this novel in verse is. And in the 20th century, although it is an age of poetry up till 1930, it is interesting that the poets continue, in many ways, the tradition of the 19th century novelist, namely to be spokesmen and the conscience of their nation. And it's interesting that the poets here again strive to write comprehensive works that would reflect a wider spectrum of their age and of the history that they are witnessing. And so we find in Dr. Zhivago the book of a modern Russian novelist who is part of the second great age that ranges from 1890 to 1930. And he too wasn't satisfied merely writing interesting experimental poetry. He felt that he had to do something on a larger scale. And so on page 58, for example, if you have the books and want to check this, he says about Zhivago, and we can really say that he can be identified with Pasternak, "Yura had a good mind and was an excellent writer. Ever since his school days, he had dreamed of composing a book about life, which would contain, like buried explosives, the most striking things he had so far seen and thought about. But he was too young to write such a book. Instead, he wrote poetry. He was like a writer, who was always making sketches for a big canvas he had in mind. He was indulgent towards these immature works on account of their vigor and originality. These two qualities, vigor and originality, in his opinion, gave reality to art, which he otherwise regarded as pointless, idle, unnecessary. Dr. Zhivago's publication in 1958 in the West was a sensation because a Russian writer, a major poet, living in the Soviet Union, defied the wishes of the ruling party and his government, and the award of the Nobel Prize and the fact that the Pasternak was made to refuse it added to the sensational aspect of the so-called Pasternak case. And what really should have been a moral event of the very first order in world literature became a pawn in the Cold War, a political sensation. And this really one has to regret, because there was a moment when this book could really kind of center and enter kind of the awareness of the world, and it was kind of deflected into a kind of pitter-patter about the few passages, anti-communist passages. And this really endangered Pasternak's life. Because, as I mentioned before, Dr. Zhivago's critique of both ideological utopianism and the smug materialism applies equally to the East and the West. That a novel animated with real Christian compassion and containing in an appendix some of the finest religious poems ever written in Russia, that this should be offered and could be offered at mid-century in the atheistic communistic Soviet Union, and that it could appear in the so-called free world that chooses to proclaim God is dead, this is indeed, to quote Edmund Wilson, one of the great events in man's literary and moral history. Now, before we look at the novel, different strands of the novel, I cannot exhaust possibly this novel in 1 hour, but I can take certain digs at it from different directions, kind of, and unravel or pull out a few of these central kind of aspects or strands from this very compact web. If you ask me what kind of a book is Dr. Zhivago, then probably on the surface, it is a simple, sometimes emotional kind of book that may remind one of a ballad or a folk song, a fairy tale. As a matter of fact, there is a poem in the appendix called Fairy Tale of St. George Fighting the Dragon. And on page 302, in the Forest Brotherhood, when Zhivago is with the partisans, there is this old witch, Kubarika, 302, who sings a song about the rowan tree. And at this point, Pasternak says the following about the Russian folk song. And I think in a way he characterizes the technique of his own novel. An old Russian folk song is like water held back by a dam. It looks as if it were still and were no longer flowing, but in its depth it is ceaselessly rushing through the sluice gates, and the stillness of its surface is deceptive. By every possible means, by repetitions and similes, the song flows down the gradual unfolding of its theme.
Pasternak wanted to be a composer before he became a poet. Then at some point, it suddenly reveals itself and astounds us. That is how the song's sorrowing spirit comes to expression. The song is an insane attempt. We could say here, the novel is an insane attempt to stop time by means of its words. By every possible means, by repetitions and similes, the song slows down the gradual unfolding of its theme. Then at some point, it suddenly reveals itself and astounds us. And really, this novel should not be compared, as was done by many critics, with Tolstoy's War and Peace, or with Dostoevsky, or with the so-called well-made psychological novel that we know from French or English literature. It is more like an ethical poem. More like an ethical poem than a psychological novel. Or you can say it is like a musical composition with variations. The critics who believed that Dr. Zhivago was to be a social analysis, a psychological novel, a well-made novel with rounded characters, they felt that Pasternak had not succeeded. They said the characters were often sketchy, and that there were very strange coincidences in the novel, which we somehow couldn't believe that this could be realistic. And Pasternak himself replied that far from trying to draw complete characters, he had tried to make them sketchy. That he wanted to present movement, life as movement, history as movement, and that he did not want man to be in the center of his view of the world. Dr. Zhivago really can be more compared with a Chinese painting than with a Western painting, if you want it better. Because man is not central. What is central in Dr. Zhivago are the seasons, the changing of the seasons, the storms, the winds, the snowfall, the descriptions of nature. And man seems to be embedded against this larger background, sometimes even dwarfed against this larger background. Nature and also history. History seen also in terms of storms and the subsiding of storms, the freezing of winter, and the freeing in the melting snow and the rains of spring. The whole novel kind of is built around this movement of death and resurrection, or the freezing of winter, of ice, and the melting snow in spring, the falling rain that wakes life up again. Now we'll come back to this later on. So far from wanting to evoke the stable ego and the stable, massive, solid, petrified world, Pasternak wanted to present life as flux, as change, as dynamic. And there are some main characters, to be sure, but even these main characters tend to be symbolic, like Dr. Zhivago. What does Zhivago mean? It means a Russian living, Dr. Living. And you'll find the other characters, too, certain symbolic qualities. I'm not saying that this is an allegory, no, but it definitely tries to see life as symbolic, human life as symbolic. And that reality is not something fixed, immutable, but that it is shot through with strange coincidences, that nature kind of takes leaps, and that it takes strange shortcuts, and that things do not move in the kind of cause-effect, definitely established relationship. Life is very full of surprises, and if you are able to see them. Now, trying to interpret Dr. Zhivago as a work of art, to grasp its compositional structure, I think if you try to do this, you find it's a very complex book, because it moves on several levels of meaning. And when I separate in the following some of these levels, then it is simply kind of to clarify the matter. But these levels really interpenetrate one another, and they are interdependent. The novel has an amazing unity. Now, I'll not tell the story, probably I should tell the story briefly, to show you the story is really very, very simple. Those of you who haven't read the novel, I will just briefly sum it up. The novel covers the time from 1901 to 1929. That is the lifetime of Dr. Zhivago. And is followed by an epilogue, which is in two parts. The first part takes place in World War II, 1943, and the end is 1953, after World War II. So really, the novel spans half a century. And who is Yuri Zhivago? Well, the book begins with the burial of his mother. He loses his mother as a small boy. His father, he hardly had known. He was a rich profligate who committed suicide. And so Yuri Zhivago grows up in the family of some friends, the Gromykos. He gets to know there the daughter of the house, Tanya, and they respect one another very much. But it's really not a great love affair so far. But when the mother, Gromyko, dies, she asks Yuri and Tanya that they should be married, they should promise kind of one to the other, because this, she thinks, would be really a great thing. And Yuri Zhivago, who tends to be a passive character, but not a characterless person, he is passive. But passive in a sense like water is passive, and you know it can do great things. And so he gives in. He gives in, and they are married. Yuri Zhivago studies medicine because he says you can't really be a poet. It's not a profession. If you make poetry a profession, then other people can tell you what to write, or you become dependent, market demand, so have some other profession. And so he studies medicine and becomes a doctor. Then when his first child is born for marriage with Sonia, he is called to arms. He has to go to the front as a physician in World War I. And there he meets for the first time the second woman character, the second most important woman character in the book, Lara. Lara, he has met her before. It's a complicated story, but I'm just telling here this is important. And he witnesses the coming of spring, the revolution of 1917 in a small village away from Moscow, his family, and there he meets Lara. This is kind of the first important meeting. After the revolution, there is famine in Moscow, and so Yuri Zhivago decides to go to the Urals, and he takes his family along, and in a very dramatic and epic train ride to the Urals, they get to the small town of Varikino, and there they settle for a while, away from the turmoil going on in the center of Russia. Now, in the Urals, Yuri meets Lara again, and here things, the romantic kind of plot thickens, and because Lara really is the great love of his life, and Tanya really is more of a relationship of respect and mutual kind of liking, but really not the great love. And this, for example, in the novel, in the movie, doesn't come out. And so some people say, well, really, it's a hymnus and adultery. And it's far from that. Now, Yuri's problems are solved by the fact that the red guerrillas, the partisans in the forest, catch him when he's riding between the two towns and the two women. And so he is taken to the forest, and there he has to work as a physician for the guerrillas. When he comes back, when he finally manages to get away from them and back to Varikino, he learns that Sonia has left the town, that she has gone with her father to Paris, that they have got some kind of permission, and Zhivago now is alone. He discovers that Lara is still there, and of course, the inevitable happens. Lara, whose husband presumably is dead, was killed in the war, but we learn later that he has he's alive and acting under an assumed name of Strelnikov, the shooter. He is the leader of an armored train who kind of runs around the countryside, carries out the rules of the party. And this husband of Lara, Strelnikov, really wants to prove to Lara that he's really a man and that he really is kind of deserving of her. At any rate, Lara is separated from her husband, and Zhivago is separated from Tonya. And so we have here a moment of peace. A moment of peace amid famine, civil war between the reds and the whites. But this is a very short duration because Lara leaves with Komarovsky, who is a rather sinister character, a minor character in the book, but in the novel, because the actor is so good, he steals the show. He's better than Lara or Zhivago, I feel. And that, again, is very lopsided. He steals the show. And this fellow Komarovsky comes along again. He is a wire puller. He has a diplomatic post somewhere in Asia, and he wants to take Lara and her child along and ask Zhivago to come along. Now, Zhivago decides not to go along. He stays there behind. Then he leaves, returns to Moscow, and there in Moscow, he really goes to seed. Because he's away from Tanya, away from Lara, he's alone, he cannot publish his poetry, he cannot even function as a doctor, because he is not a communist and he doesn't want to compromise his views. There is another love affair, and very ironically now, with the daughter of the butler in their house. And you can see how the social whole structure has been kind of turned upside down. And in the end, Zhivago dies during a thunderstorm when he's riding a streetcar, and he feels he just doesn't have enough air to breathe, and he wants to open the window that has been nailed down with boards. And this exertion is too much, and he dies of a heart attack on the pavement in front of the streetcar. Now, this is very briefly the story. Now, Pastor Zhivago is a poet, and he has left some poems, and these poems are added as an appendix to the novel, and these poems are read by his friends after World War II. And they read these novels as a testament of their friend and as a promise of a better future, because they say the world war isn't just a game of chess. All these people who have died cannot have died in vain. There must come some kind of liberalization, some kind of freedom. And these novels of Yuri Zhivago, for the most part, religious poems, strengthen them in this belief. Now, this is very, very briefly the story. Now, let's look at the novel from different kind of points of view. First of all, and this is perhaps the most obvious level, the novel is the life of an artist. The main character, Dr. Zhivago, is a poet. The novel is actually a portrait of a genius. His strengths, his weaknesses, his contradictions, the problems of aesthetics that preoccupy him. We learn how poems are being written, with the actual poems given in the end as the fruit of this poet's life and experiences. It is not a book about a known artist, you know. We have novels, kind of fictional biographies of Beethoven, you know, or somebody else. But here we have really an invented major poet who does not merely write poems, and the novelist says, well, he's famous, he wrote poems, but we never can check. But we have the actual poems of this invented character at the end of the novel. And they are not Pasternak's own novels. They grow out of the novel, out of the life of this fictional character, Zhivago. And it's really fascinating to see. You should read the novel backwards, from the poems into the novel. Because the novel kind of is nothing but the material, the grist, so to speak, for this handful of poems. And some of the major experiences of Zhivago aren't even registered in the poem. And some minor one, a candle burning in a window, becomes the central theme of one of the most moving poems. This is how the creative mind works. It doesn't work to order. It doesn't work according to a certain pattern, or if you give it a theme, it kind of writes about it. So you learn quite a bit about the work of the creative imagination. It is a unique book in this respect, really a unique book in world literature. I don't know of any other major novel that does exactly this. And Donald Davy, an English critic, has written a book about it, The Poems of Dr. Zhivago, where he interprets each poem as a key to the novel. See, many critics felt embarrassed by these poems. They felt, well, Pasternak probably didn't, he felt the novel wasn't good enough, so he added the poems, or he wanted to smuggle out some poems along with the novel, you know. And that is really kind of taking a very simple view of Pasternak. The problem that Zhivago as a poet faces is how to maintain one's integrity as a human being and as a poet in an age that demands acquiescence to the official lie and to the ever-charging party, changing party line. In some ways, Dr. Zhivago is a pathetic, in some ways a heroic figure, yet never a simplified, whitewashed hero. You see, the socialist realism demanded that the author should present positive heroes always, always goody-goody boys. And Stalin said that the writer is the engineer of human souls. And if you don't know what socialist realism is, perhaps the best definition was given by Andrei Sinyavsky, the Russian writer who, after Pasternak, smuggled some books out into the West and published them under the pseudonym of Abraham Terts. And then it was this year that they discovered who this Terp was Sinyavsky, a friend of Pasternak's. And Sinyavsky says that socialist realism, he says, is that you take an ideal and you set it up and you mold reality according to this ideal. Whatever doesn't fit, you cut off. So Zhivago, then, is not a socialist, realist, positive hero, but he's a man who is confused, who is in many instances weak, contradictory. And these are qualities that we kind of expect of a novel and a novelist's character. But in Russia, this is quite revolutionary. And the conflict of Zhivago between Tonya and Lara, this also adds to the realism of the figure. Now, since it is a book about a poet, it contains references to his relationships with his predecessors and contemporaries, especially in Russian literature. From the Easter liturgies of the Orthodox Church to the legends and the fairy tales and folk songs, and then down to Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov, and to the moderns. In one way, Dr. Zhivago is an anthology of Russian literature, of what is best and most original in it. Just one quote about Pushkin on page 237, for example. He says, "What happened when Pushkin entered Russian literature?" And here, I think, again, Pasternak described, as so often a writer does, the qualities he himself admires in literature. Air, light, the noise of life, reality burst into his poetry from the street as through an open window. The outside world, everyday things, nouns, crowded in and took possession of his lines, driving out the vaguer parts of speech. Things and more things lined up in rhymed columns on the page. And on Chekhov, for example, on 238, the next page, he says, "What I have come to like best in the whole of Russian literature is the childlike quality of Pushkin and Chekhov, their modest reticence in such high-sounding matters as the ultimate purpose of mankind or their own salvation. It isn't that they didn't think about these things, and to good effect, but to talk about such things seemed to them pretentious, presumptuous. Gogol, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky looked restlessly for the meaning of life and prepared for death and balanced accounts. Pushkin and Chekhov, right up to the end of their lives, were absorbed in the current specific tasks imposed on them by their vocation as writers. And in the course of fulfilling these tasks, they lived their lives quietly, treating both their lives and their work as private, individual matters of no concern to anyone else. And these individual things have since become of concern to all. And their work, like apples picked while they are green, have ripened of themselves, mellowed gradually, and growing richer in meaning. There are many passages that speak to us about art. For example, page 235. Let's stay right around there. For example, he says, what is art? I have always thought that art is not a category, not a realm covering innumerable concepts and derivative phenomena, but that on the contrary, it is something concentrated, strictly limited. It is a principle that is present in every work of art, a force applied to it, and a truth worked out in it. And I have never seen art as form, but rather as a hidden, secret part of content. A literary creation can appeal to us in all sorts of ways, by its theme, subject, situations, characters. But above all, it appeals to us by the presence in it of art. It is the presence of art in Crime and Punishment that moves us deeply, rather than the story of Raskolnikov's crime. And then he says, primitive art, the art of Egypt, Greece, our own, is all, I think, one and the same art through thousands of years. You can call it an idea, a statement about life, so all-embracing that it can't be split up into separate words. And if there is so much as a particle of it in any work that includes other things as well, it outweighs all the other ingredients and significance and turns out to be the essence, the heart and soul of the work. Now this idea, this statement about life, so all-embracing, this kind of evocation of the unity of being is what Pasternak, too, is concerned in his book, is concerned with in his book. Then on page 378, I'm just picking out a few kind of quotes here to show you how interesting it is from this point of view as the biography of a poet, of a practicing poet, as a kind of view of a creative mind. 378, that's the bottom of the page there. As he scribbled his odds and ends, he made a note, reaffirming his belief that art always serves beauty. Now you say, ah, an aesthetic kind of, you know, strange nut here. What about the other categories of Kierkegaard? That art always serves beauty, comma, and beauty is delight in form, and form is the key to organic life. Since no living thing can exist without it, so that every work of art, including tragedy, expresses the joy of existence. So that every work of art, including tragedy, expresses the joy of existence. The splendid imagery that we see, of course, in the book, throughout the book, not only in the poems, but in the descriptions, in the evocations of seasons, of different phenomena in nature. These descriptions, of course, are all the work of a poet, and they are very much apropos because the author is the poet, not only the author of the novel, but the central character. And here again, just think of the epical train ride to the Urals, the coming of spring, the meeting with the waterfall, and all these things. These are all explanations and kind of illustrations of the novel as the life of an artist or a poet. Now, since it's a book about a poet, written by a poet himself, the very style and composition, as I give these illustrations, are poetic evocations full of startling metaphors, and sometimes a sharply seen individual scene is made to present a whole complex historical event. You know, sometimes novelists pretend to be that they are God, that they know everything. And from hindsight, of course, they can explain everything. Pasternak presents us with a confusion of the present. Many people who witnessed the revolution didn't see it all. They didn't see it was a great thing. Some of them saw it was a pathetic thing, or didn't even know what was going on. So in the novel, Pasternak uses kind of a modern technique, and that is to remove perspective. If you witness events in the present, you are confused usually. You don't have the total view. It's only later, by hindsight and by elimination, that you begin to understand what's going on. And others tell you what went on. You say, oh, yeah, that's right. That's exactly my idea, too, you know. But when the things happen hard and fast around you, in the thick of it, you know, you are confused. And you, some of the people, even know the revolution was going on. Only later they learned about it. And then, of course, they told all the stories, how importantly they participated in it. And so this confusing quality of history, this complexity of reality, I think comes through in the novel and is intentionally there, this confusion. And so we come to the second level. It is a historical novel, obviously. The time, as I mentioned before, is from 1901 to 1929, with the epilogue written 1943-53. We witness, directly or indirectly, through minor scenes, or some major ones, the toppling of the Tsarist regime, the civil war between the whites and the reds, the revolution, the First and the Second World War, the frontline descriptions, and the forest brotherhood of the red partisans or guerrilla bands. We learn something about the cruel years of the so-called NEP period under Stalin in the 20s. And the action moves from Moscow to the Urals and back, and the whole expanse of Russia is evoked. Yet, no glorification of recent Russian history is attempted, and no simple explanation in terms of Marx either. Politics interests Dr. Zhivago less than trying to understand and to salvage the fullness and the depth of life. Just one quote from page 247 to illustrate the implications of this particular level. 247. Here we have Lara speaking with Zhivago, and they talk about her husband, who she has found out is alive and is the leader of the partisans, Strelnikov, a man who has kind of erased his name and become a shooter, so to speak, in the name of an ideology, in the name of the party. And here he says about revolutionaries. Says he's a doomed man. I believe that he'll come to a bad end. He will atone for the evil he has done. Revolutionaries who take the law into their own hands are horrifying, not because they are criminals, but because they are like machines that have got out of control, like runaway trains. Or then on page 282, while Zhivago is in the forest with the partisans, he talks with the partisan leader, who talks all the time about reshaping life, you know, and improving it, and as always, with all ideologies and utopias, the things are in the future, you know. I mean, you just suffer now, I mean, you just get shot now, you know, but the children, your children's children, they will have the freedom, they will have the good, you see. So now it may hurt, you know, but later, you see, will be the paradise. It's always later. And so Zhivago says on page 282, reshaping life. People who can say that have never understood a thing about life. They have never felt its breath, its heartbeat, however much they have seen or done. They look on it as a lump of raw material that needs to be processed by them, to be ennobled by their touch. But life is never a material, a substance to be molded. If you want to know, life is the principle of self-renewal. It is constantly renewing and remaking and changing and transfiguring itself. It is infinitely beyond your or my obtuse theories about it. And then he says, for example, that he doesn't like politicians because he doesn't like people who don't have a respect for truth. He just puts it like that. Now, it is, of course, a novel of ideas. Right, the first chapter of the 5 o'clock express reveals the basically Christian orientation of the whole novel. With Christ begins history for Pasternak. The history of free individuals and no more of groups, parties, and peoples. It is the end of religions. It is the setting free of man in a direct dialogue with God, his creator. It is the end of ideologies and systems, because Christ means for Pasternak the free confrontation of God and man in the love of Christ. Let me just give you a few quotes for this. Right on page 12, for example, begins right on this note. We talk about some writers and authors, and the uncle of Zhivago says, yes, there are gifted men, but the fashion nowadays is all for groups and societies of every sort. Gregariousness is always the refuge of mediocrities, whether they swear by Solovyov, a Russian mystical philosopher, or Kant, or Marx. Only individuals seek the truth, and they shun those whose sole concern is not the truth. How many things in the world deserve our loyalty? Asks Boris Pasternak, the Russian writer in the Soviet Union in the middle of the 20th century. Very few indeed, he answers. I think one should be loyal to immortality, which is another word for life, a stronger word for life. One must be true to immortality, true to Christ. And then, on the next page, 13, he goes on to explain this. He says, it is possible not to know whether God exists or why, and yet believe that man does not live in a state of nature, but in history, and that history as we know it began with Christ, and that Christ's gospel is its foundation. And he says, well, what is the basic equipment of the gospel? Simply. And Pasternak says, to begin with, love of one's neighbor, which is a supreme form of vital energy. Interesting. Once it fills the heart of man, it has to overflow and spend itself. But you can't demand it. You can't require it with a cudgel or with a whip. And then the two basic ideals of modern man. Without them, he's unthinkable. The idea of free personality and the idea of life as sacrifice. And just to continue on page 15, every motion in the world taken separately was calculated and purposeful, but taken together, and here again the whole novel, you see, illustrates this. There's not a thing that Pasternak thinks that he doesn't illustrate and embody in his novel. Every motion in the world taken separately was calculated and purposeful, but taken together, they were spontaneously intoxicated with the general stream of life which united them. The freedom came from the feeling that all human lives were interrelated, a certainty that they flowed into each other, a happy feeling that all events took place not only on the earth, in which the dead are buried, but also in some other region which some call the kingdom of God, others history, and still others by some other name. Page 39. I quoted already this passage where he says that it's the inner music, the irresistible power of an inner truth that draws men to Christianity, and not the cudgel and the whip. Or then on page 40, where he speaks how suddenly things changed. He says, the ancient world ended with Rome because of overpopulation. Rome was a flea market, he says, of borrowed gods and conquered peoples, a bargain basement on two floors, earth and heaven, a mass of filth convoluted in a triple knot as in an intestinal obstruction. Dacians, Herulians, Scythians, Sarmatians, Hyperboreans, heavy wheels without spokes, eyes sunk in fat, sodomy, double chins, illiterate emperors, fish fed on the flesh of learned slaves. There were more people in the world than there ever have been since, all crammed into the passages of the Colosseum and all wrecked. And then, into this tasteless heap of gold and marble, he came, light and clothed in an aura, emphatically human, deliberately provincial Galilean. And at that moment, gods and nations ceased to be, and man came into being. Man the carpenter, man the plowman, man the shepherd with his flock of sheep at sunset. Man who does not sound in the least proud. Man thankfully celebrated in all the cradle songs of mothers and in all the picture galleries the world over. So, it is a novel of ideas, and it sees history as really beginning with the coming of Christ. And although there are theoretical passages, many others that I can quote here, and long discussions between protagonists about theological, philosophical matters, still Pasternak is not a philosopher nor a theologian. For him, truth is concrete, to be seen, tasted, smelled, touched, delighted in, because he is a poet. And thus the themes of freedom and love, for example, do not float about in the novel in the abstract, but are acted out in living people who are part of a total which is God's creation, the elements, the changing seasons. As I said before, the novel could be called not just Dr. Living, as it is called, but Death and Resurrection. Resurrection in nature, in Christ, in the poems that survive Zhivago, in love. This resurrection, this revivification, vivification is being celebrated again and again. And here we kind of touch upon the Russian Orthodox Church. I think Dr. Zhivago is one of the best introductions into the Russian Orthodox and the Greek Orthodox Church, because it stresses the Easter, the miracle of Easter, of resurrection. As a matter of fact, the Russians don't have a word for Sunday. We call Sunday the day of the sun. It's very pagan. The Russians call the Sunday resurrection. Every Sunday reminds them of the fact of the resurrection, which is the key, really, the center of the Christian kind of understanding of life, I think. They do not stress so much the passion. They stress more the resurrection, the new being, the glad tidings of the Evangelion. On a fourth level, it is a love story, not just because of the triangle, Zhivago, Lara, and Sonia, the villain Komarovsky, Pasha, Strelnikov, and Lara. No, Dr. Zhivago, as I told you, means in translation Dr. Living, life. Life, a free and abundant life that cannot be made to fit into any system or ideology. Life against the reshaping of which fights Dr. Zhivago. The life that is understood here is love. And Lara emerges as the strongest figure of the book. Lara is perhaps even stronger than Dr. Zhivago. And all the male characters are drawn to her. Pasha Antipov, her husband. Komarovsky, the villain. Zhivago, her lover. All of these men are drawn to her because she is a symbol of life abundant. A woman who is loving herself and to be loved, who is strong and yet pliable, associated through the imagery of the book with water, with the rain, with floods, with the wind, with sea. Let's just take one quote for this. Page 121. This is the description where Zhivago meets, really, for the first time, Lara at the front, when he is to leave home. And there you have the symbol, for example, page 121. The windows were open. Whenever Lara is there, the windows are usually open. She's associated with the symbol of the window and the wind, the freshness coming in through the window. In the room, the scent of linden blossoms mingled as in an old park, with a caraway bitter smell of dry twigs and the charcoal fumes of the two flat irons that Antipova, as Lara, used alternately, putting them each in turn in the flue to keep them hot. And then she leaves. She leaves, and there's a tremendous storm that night. And Zhivago is in this house, another old lady too, and he hears somebody knocking in the storm. And they go up to the room to see who is knocking. And in Lara's room, page 127, "You are well right," says the old lady. "There is no one." She had been all around the house. A branch knocking on the pantry window had broken one of the panes, and there were huge puddles on the floor. And the same thing in what used to be Lara's room. There was a sea, a real sea, an ocean. And on this side, look, there's a broken shutter knocking on the casement. Do you see it? That's all it was. They had been sure that when they opened the door, Antipova would come in, chilled through and soaked to the skin, And they would ask her dozens of questions while she took off her things and so on. Now, this is just one reference. Or then in page 398, when Pasternak meets the last love of his life, Marina, the butler's daughter, she's called Marina. See? They meet while she's carrying water to the party. So the women are usually associated with the element of water, very strongly. And everything that associates, the freshness and so on. When Tonya gives birth to the first child of Zhivago, she lies there exhausted. And Pasternak compares her with a ship that has unloaded its cargo of souls coming from another world. And when Zhivago dies, his coffin is roughly hewn and it's put on his desk where he's written his poems. And Pasternak says, it looked like a roughly hewn canoe. So here you have, again, the image of the ship, the image of the sea, of the water, kind of running through as symbols of life very, very strongly. And Yuri's death in the streetcar, you know, to breathe fresh air that has come after the storm has broken. There again, he dies because he cannot open the thing. But whenever he is with Lara, whenever he can kind of be resurrected again, the window is open, and he has contact with the kind of refreshing qualities of nature. Now, this problem, the elements, is a tremendous one in the novel. I'll return to this in a few minutes. In the end of the book, Lara and Yuri discuss the meaning of love, and this is done in Christian terms. And the personal, individual, intimate sphere, not the public, official one, is being celebrated. And perhaps one of the most beautiful passages is the chapter that begins on page 362, where Yuri and Lara, with her daughter, are in this abandoned villa. And it is very cold. They have only one room that they have heated. And they have really splurged because they have heated some water. And so Lara has washed her child. And the whole kind of room breathes peace and quiet and cleanliness. And there at the desk sits Zhivago and he writes poems. First of all, there is the candle that burns on his desk. Within the circle of the candle sits Zhivago, the poet, the kind of doctor living himself, the creative artist and the doctor who administers to life in an age that meets out death and destruction. As a poet, he wants to keep language living and vital and flowing. As a doctor, he wants to administer to life and not to death. They both go hand in hand. There he sits, in this small, warm, light circle of the candle in front of his white paper. Then the other circle includes Lara and her daughter and the safety, the relative safety of this room. Outside of the house, the moonlight making another circle. Further away, the wolves are howling and threatening this moment of peace. It's almost like the eye in the center of a storm, because there are the wolves, there is famine, there is civil war, an ever-widening surf, but in the center is peace. For one moment, for a few moments, rare moments, it is an island of warmth, of light, of love, of life, and of creativity. And all these really come together for this in this one moment. There are other moments like this. And here we have a marvelous description of how poetry is being written. If you read this passage carefully, I think you'll understand what I mean. Now, finally, on the fifth level, and I will not keep you beyond an hour because I know you are tired, it is a novel of nature. A novel of nature in a very special sense. History and biography are seen in the perspective of and enmeshed in the changing seasons, the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. Now, Pasternak says, with the coming of Christ, man does no longer live in nature, he lives in history. He doesn't take that back with his novel. But for him, history and nature really are interdependent in the term of God's creation. God's creation is a sacramental concept, and it includes everything or nothing. It doesn't believe in setting one above the other, of making man the total kind of center of creation. And here, you can, again, I return what I said at the beginning of my lecture. Death is associated with freezing and ice and snow. Life with the melting floods and the life-giving quality of rain. Ideologies are presented as a hardening, a petrification, a solidification, like ice. And if you can overcome it, you melt again, you give yourself, become part of the world. And the communists, the ideologists, the utopianists are presented as machines, as hardened, as ice-cold, planning and acting according to plans, running as if they were machines and not human beings, full of contradictions and confusions and the ability to give. It is true, then, that since the coming of Christ, man no longer lives in nature, but in history, that has a beginning and a foreseeable end. But this does not set up man as an absolute master above the rest of nature, as some kind of disembodied pure spirit. Let's turn to page 417. Lara spells this out at Yuri's coffin. She says on page 417, she says, what had been their love? What had been their concept of life? This unity with the, never, even in their moment of richest and wildest happiness, were they unaware of the sublime joy in the total design of the universe, a feeling that they themselves were a part of that whole, an element in the beauty of the cosmos. This unity with the whole was the breath of life to them, and the elevation of man above the rest of nature, the modern coddling and worshipping of man, never appealed to them. A social system based on such a false premise, as well as its political applications, struck them as pathetically amateurish and made no sense to them. And therefore, Pasternak is almost anti-psychology in an age of psychoanalysis, you know. I mean, we just explain everything, sin and everything in terms of, you know, complexes and the Freud has just, you know, made things so easy. Pasternak kind of makes them complex again and says that man is really a mystery. As God's creation, he's a mystery. The world is a mystery. Nature is a mystery. Love is a mystery. And he does not want to define it and spell it out. And here, just one quote, I see this in context here. Lara is crying as she speaks about these experiences with Zhivago. She said it was these tears that seemed to hold her words together in a tender, quick whispering like the rustling of silky leaves in a warm, windy rain. Again, the element of water comes to add it to tears, whatever it is, always liquefying, always freeing. And then on page 118, he says how often we wish to escape from words. I can get tired of words. He says the commissar's naivete embarrassed him, but the sly sophistication of the commandant and his aide, too sneering and dissembling opportunists, was no better. The foolishness of one was matched by the slyness of the others. And all this expressed itself in a torrent of words, superfluous, utterly false, murky, profoundly alien to life itself. Oh, how one wishes sometimes to escape from the meaningless dullness of human eloquence, from all those sublime phrases, to take refuge in nature, apparently so inarticulate, or in the wordlessness of long, grinding labor. I'm sure Carol Hindle appreciates that. Of sound sleep, of true music, or of human understanding rendered speechless by emotion. And right in the next page, this view of kind of the totality of life as a living, you know, as a developing dynamic thing. McGill in his book Celebration of Flesh says it took a German to define God as the ground of being, you know, like a rock, you know, underlying it. If you would define, we'd say it's life, or a vivifying principle. It's life eternal, the living word, resurrection, you know, but the ground of being, you know, there it is, you know. This is the solidity, the rock on which I build, you see, and with the rock you go down in the sea. So this view of God is not the view that Pastor Nath presents at all. And so on page 119, he describes an evening in the village near the battlefront. An enormous crimson moon rose behind the crow's nest in the countess's garden. At first it was the color of the new brick mill in Zibushino. Then it turned yellow like the water tower at Biryuchi. And just under the window, the smell of new-mown hay, as perfumed as jasmine tea, mixed with that of belladonna. Below there, a cow was tethered. She had been brought from a distant village. She had walked all day. She was tired and homesick for the herd and would not yet accept food from her new mistress. "Now, now, hold on there. I'll show you how to butt," her mistress coaxed her in a whisper. But the cow crossly shook her head and craned her neck, mooing plaintively, and beyond the black barns of Melyuzeyevo the stars twinkled, and invisible threads of sympathy stretched between them and the cow, as if there were cattle sheds in other worlds where she was pitied. The novel as a novel of nature. Man lives in time, in a country, in a culture, in the body, in the senses. He feels the rhythm of the changing seasons, and he certainly is not beside, outside, or above them. He does not float like a disembodied spirit above the waters. How much unnecessary cruelty and destruction has been brought upon the nature that surrounds us and upon the animal kingdom by the license that seems to be given in the phrase that man is the master of nature. Already Rousseau kind of began to worry about this and was very often misunderstood. And today, I think sensitive young people who are tired of an exclusively anthropocentric worldview that has led to two of the most terrible wars and mass murder on an incredible scale, the destruction of our natural resources, and the general feeling of hopelessness and absurdity. These young people turn to Zen Buddhism for a worldview that integrates reason and man into a more comprehensive and less one-sided cosmic design. Isn't this a pity that Christianity has not been able to come earlier to grips with the problem of nature? This charge must be leveled, I think, most strongly against us Protestants, least so against the Greek and the Russian Orthodox churches, which have always stressed more strongly the word incarnate than the pure logos, the resurrection of Easter more so than Christmas or even Passion Week. And I think this explains also Pasternak's fondness for nature. It is not a reversion to paganism, but simply a beautiful evocation of the Easter spirit, the stress on the new being that inspires the Russian Orthodox Church. A sacramental view of nature is expressed. Just think of the Lenten text, page 344. Lara said something very nice about them. 344. I need some water. Pastor Nach symbol. Lara says, "It may be wrong of me, but I don't like the Lenten text on the curbing of the senses and the mortification of the flesh. They are curiously flat and clumsy and without the poetry of other spiritual writings. I always think they were composed by fat monks. Not that I care if they themselves broke the rules and deceived other people or if they lived according to their conscience. It's not that. It's not they that I'm concerned with, but with the actual content of these passages. All these acts of contrition give too much importance to various infirmities of the flesh and to whether it is fat or famished. It's repulsive. It seems to me to raise something dirty, unimportant, inconsequential to a dignity that does not belong to it. I've always wondered why Mary Magdalene is mentioned on the very eve of Easter, just before the death and resurrection of Christ." And then she says also, later, I mean, she stresses the fact that Christ is a gardener, you know. She was mistaken for the gardener. And here we have kind of the Eden, in Eden, life beginning, and Christ, I mean, in the second Eden, as the gardener who takes charge of the garden, takes charge of everything. And so the possibility of paradise is given again in the resurrection. And we have kind of a new access to nature as a paradise garden, believes Pasternak. Now, I think there is a real challenge here to us Lutherans, who are heirs, I think, to German theological, philosophical, abstract speculations, a tradition that tends to stress problems of abstract moral and ethical conduct and pays less attention to the concrete existential drama which is human life, in time and in the flesh. I think the Protestant churches, perhaps, are more subject to the temptations of spiritual pride, the pride of purity, than the Russian Orthodox Church. The current popularity of existentialism and Zen Buddhism have pointed up definite weaknesses in the Christian tradition that is rooted in Protestantism and the philosophy of German idealism, which has tended to minimize the existential conflict and the role of man as part of nature and, as a consequence, leading to this spiritual pride, systematic theology, and otherworldliness that isolates some Protestants from the constant impact of immediate and often confusing reality, sensuous social reality. Truth becomes a series of pat answers and is no longer a living search and a painful encounter, a confusing choice. Now, Dr. Living places truth into a living, pulsating context. It embodies, incarnates this truth, and makes it concrete, so that we grasp the truth not only with our minds, but equally with all our senses, our sensibility, and our imagination. Thus, abstract concepts, life, truth, freedom, individualism, love, become, so to speak, liquefied again, vivified again in the flow of living reality. Dramatic possibilities of human encounters and released from the shadowy world of systematic philosophy and systematic theology with an abstract jargon. The word must become flesh again and again in order to be understood and effective. This is the deepest wisdom, I think, of all really great poetry, and Pasternak certainly is a great poet. I would like to conclude with a poem from Zhivago. If you just give me 5 more minutes, I have kept you here for 1 hour, but 5 more minutes, I hope you'll forgive me. It is a poem in Holy Week, and it sums up very well this sacramental view of nature, the church year and the natural year, kind of intermix. I would like to read it to you, if my voice doesn't give out. The first 3 stanzas in Russian, and then the poem itself in English. The first 3 stanzas do something impossible. You can't translate it, because there are 20 identical rhymes, all ending on la. One translator tried it to do with light and sight and mice and flight, you know, but that just doesn't come off. And of course, you know, in the Russian church, you don't have an organ. You don't have just one bell, you have many bells. And so this here you have the bell calling the faithful to the service. In Holy Week. Just listen a little bit to the Russian quality here, and then I'll give you the whole poem in German, in English, German. На Страстной. Еще кругом ночная мгла, еще так рано в мире, что звездам в небо нет числа, и каждая как день светла. И если бы земля могла, она бы Пасху проспала по чтение псалтыри. Еще кругом ночная мгла, такая рань на свете, что площадь вечностью легла от перекрестка до угла, и до рассвета и тепла еще тысяча лет. Around us still the dark of night, and still so early in the world, that stars unnumbered range the sky, each shining with a day's clear light, and if it could, the earth upcurled would wearily through Easter tide sleep to the chanting of the psalms. Around us still the dark of night, and still so early in the world, that like eternity the square, like eternity the square corner to a crossroad is unfurled, and dawn and warmth are out of sight, more than a thousand years away. And still the earth in nakedness has naught to wear by night to ring the chapel bell out in response to where inside the choir sings. And from Thursday of Holy Week till Holy Saturday begins, the water plows the river banks and in its eddying whirlpool spins, stripped down and bare the forest rears. And when Christ's passion comes to pass, its host of lofty pine trees stand like worshippers attending mass. And in the town, where like a rally they crowd together down the ways, the trees in their pure nakedness in through the church's grating great gaze. And awe transfixes all their glances, alarm that you may well forgive. For gardens burst out through their fences, and earth's foundations quake and move, and God is born into the grave. They see the light, the royal gate, the rows of candles, the black pall, the faces deeply stained with tears. But suddenly before them all, a concourse with a shroud appears. Two birches standing at the gate must bow aside to let them pass. Around the yard goes the procession, and back along the pavement's edge to bear the spring. Spring's conversation along the street into the porch, and air with flavors of baked bread and heady vapors of the spring. Now March is scattering the snow on groups of cripples in the porch, as though someone had brought the shrine outside, and to them, each and each, had given all he could bestow. So lasts the singing till the dawn, and when they cease their lengthy weep, the psalms and acts on silent feet now in the stillness softly creep into an empty lamplit street. And men and beasts at midnight hush to hear this rumor in the spring, that in the changing weather's hour, death finds its only vanquishing through the resurrection power. Well, I think that Dr. Zhivago is a book that belongs to Holden, and I think that this point of view of the sacramental unity of all being needs to be stressed, I think, right from this very rugged pulpit. Thank you very much.